This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. This summer, America turns 250 years old, and there's no better way to celebrate than getting outside and exploring this great nation. One way to do that is to rent a camper or RV from Outdoorsy. Outdoorsy is the most trusted RV rental marketplace in the U.S., making it easy for anyone over 21 to rent an RV or camper without owning one. With Outdoorsy, you can drive it yourself, tow it, or even have it delivered and fully set up at your destination. With comprehensive insurance, 24/7 customer support, and roadside assistance, Outdoorsy gives you the peace of mind you need when on the road. Outdoorsy is even the perfect option for your next out-of-state hunting or fishing trip. Right now, my listeners can have all service fees removed from their bookings in 2026 with code EMPIRE at Outdoorsy.com. That's Outdoorsy.com and use code EMPIRE at checkout to remove service fees. It's time to get outside and enjoy your summer. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan & Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum. Basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
When it's time to go after the biggest buck of your life, you need gear that will not only make your life easier, but that you can also depend on for years to come. Lone Wolf Custom Gear has been the leader in mobile hunting equipment for over 40 years and started out right here in Wisconsin. From inventing the climbing stick to perfecting ultralight tree stands, Lone Wolf Custom Gear continues to innovate and put the best mobile hunting equipment on the market with a ton of fantastic accessories that allow you to customize your gear exactly how you want it. Whether it be the high-end DeQuisto series sticks and stands or the affordable Patriot series, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that you're hanging off of gear that was 100% made in the USA, right here in the Midwest, in fact, and has been designed and perfected by some of the best whitetail hunters in the world. Not to mention, it has an unconditional lifetime warranty that's so good your grandkids and even great-grandkids will be able to use it when they're hunting. Go build your kit out today at lonewolfcustomgear.com.
E-scouting is the crucial first step to any great adventure, but sometimes we gotta swap the muck boots for flip-flops and the shotguns for fishing rods and get out on the water to recharge those batteries. Whether you're in search of the lunker that broke you off last summer or trying to get the family out for a day on the water, you need to have a game plan. That's where Onyx Fish comes into play. With detailed bathymetry maps, expert information, historical fisheries data, and filters that allow you to hone in on your next favorite lake for a multitude of species, this is an angler's best friend. Shoot, I'm actually planning a father-son trip to the North Woods with some buddies right now, and I already feel like I've got a game plan in place to catch more fish than the rest of those guys. And the best part is, it's easy, intuitive, and based on the same platform as our beloved Onyx Hunt app. Go check it out today and start finding your next honey hole at onxmaps.com/fish.
Turkey season is here, and when it comes time to hit the woods and chase some gobbles, you need gear that's as ready to hunt as you are. That's why I'm proud to be partnered with Huntworth Gear. This spring, I'll be running around the woods in the Durham lightweight pants, which have been my go-to pants for everything the last couple of years. They've got a waterproof seat and knee panels that keep you dry when setting up, and breathable, quick-drying fabric to keep you comfortable after a long walk through tall, dewy grass, or when you're putting on the miles looking for that lonely long beard. On top, I'll be wearing the Grayling Heat Boost hoodie if it's cold and the Camden lightweight hoodie when it's hot. And don't forget the Ames lightweight gloves with fingerless index and thumb holes that give you the dexterity you need to run those calls unimpeded all season long. Go build your kit out today at huntworthgear.com or visit the hunting section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to find it in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies. And one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or just looking to get out and try something new. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd even venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. The Wisconsin BHA chapter was formed to provide a voice to hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy. And everyone involved works their tails off to protect public lands and access those public lands and waters. Stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what we have going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Lone Wolf Custom Gear. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're all doing well. I hope June is off to a fantastic start for all of you. This is the first time, like this week, I feel like is the first time that I've had to actually sort of sit and like review this spring as a whole. Like, I don't know about you guys, but for me, it was an absolute blur of running around, scouting for guide trips, doing those guide trips, turkey hunting whenever I could, trying to get podcasts out, and just like stay on top of work and everything else. And it was just, it seemed like a nonstop sprint. And in the moment, I'm kind of kicking myself because I don't feel like I enjoyed it while it was happening. I don't feel like I actually got to like really sit in all the cool stuff that happened this spring. But I mean, laid into a bunch of good fish. Like I said it, I think, on the Nine Finger Chronicles. Like, I don't want to jinx myself here, but I think I'm on a hot streak right now of just finding a lot of really good fish. Like last night, just knocking around a little smallmouth creek, which I've been trying to explore a lot of this spring whenever I've had time. I ended up churning up a really, really nice, angry 18-inch female who was, I'm not proud of it. She may have still been spawning. I couldn't see a bed. She came out of nowhere. It didn't look like a bedding area, but what do? She ate and got her in the net, took a quick picture and let her go, but she still had some eggs in her. Saw a couple of males fry guarding still. It's just kind of a weird sort of transitional stage of the smallmouth season right now, but you know, looking back, found a lot of good trout, had some good turkey hunts in between a lot of really bad turkey hunts. I was talking with Tony Peterson last week, and, you know, we were both kind of like, turkey season wasn't bad, but it definitely wasn't good, I don't think. At least where we were at least the conditions on the days that we got to hunt. Like, the day that I killed my bird in, let's see, what was it, during period three, that was like the best day of turkey hunting I've ever seen in my life. Like, dead calm wind. I think it was like 31 degrees that morning, like kind of frosty, dewy, like just cold. And you could hear birds gobble, like I'm talking like a mile, mile and a half up and down the valley. Like, you sneezed and something would gobble at you. It was just ridiculous. And so like, that was an awesome day, but then trying to replicate that success or trying to replicate those conditions, I found myself questioning whether or not I knew what I was even doing as a turkey hunter quite often. And so that was kind of not a bummer. I think we all need checks like that when we're in the woods, because last year I had a really, really good season. So I think I was due for a tough year, but what do? You know, but enough about me. I've got my man, Paul Anir, on the line. We're going to be doing a little BS session here. We're going to be talking trail cams, summer deer stuff. But first off, I want to hear, Paul, about your turkey season and whether or not you thought the spring was a little off as well.
Yeah, I kind of had an up and down season too. I would categorize it as wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. So this year was kind of me over the winter prioritizing my kids in the youth season, which is like mid to late April. So we went out, my dad drove up here to Northeast Wisconsin, and we got a couple blinds set up on some permission farms. They're actually connecting. So we were kind of calling to the same birds a little bit of the morning potentially. But we had some, what I would say, good success for like a youth hunter. We got some birds in close. My 10-year-old son with my dad had one hang up at 40 yards, just kind of behind a rise, and wouldn't commit. We didn't have decoys set out. I go back and forth on decoys. I don't know. And they didn't have anything out. I kind of said, yeah, let's just try no decoys and see what happens. And one hung up and wouldn't commit. So that was cool. It was gobbling all the way in, gobbled after he walked away. I mean, it was a really cool experience for my oldest son. And then I took my middle child out, and we had one out in a cornfield, standing up on a rise, gobbling like crazy, standing there for like 10 minutes straight. He didn't come down either. Then we had a couple of Jakes come through at like 60 or 70 yards following a hen. So they saw plenty of birds. So that was really cool. I mean, it was just awesome for them to get out and like have an interaction with birds and like get the experience, you know?
Totally.
The calling and the vocalization, like that's what it's all about. And that's what we love, right? Like, a silent bird is, yeah, I mean, I'll take it. But I mean, the vocalizations and the interaction is like where it's at, right? And especially for like, you know, a 10 and a 8-year-old boy. Yeah, it was awesome. So it was really cool. They didn't end up killing anything on Sunday of youth season either, but it was just a really cool experience for them to get out and kind of see what it's all about. I didn't make them crawl out of bed at 4:30 either. I mean, we got out at like 7 a.m. I kind of know like the DNA of this property. And if you're out there like 7 a.m. to 10, 11 a.m., that's like a really good time to be out there. And I just didn't want my kids, like, I didn't want to peel them up out of bed, like on an empty stomach and go sit in the woods and like, hey, be quiet for 4 hours now. You know, like I just didn't want that. I know how kind of miserable that was for me as a youth hunter. And I just was like, you know, let's just go out whenever we wake up and we'll just hustle out there right away. And that's what happened. And we still had quote unquote success. So that was youth season. And then for myself, I had a third season up here in Wisconsin. And my first hunt of the year where I was behind the gun was successful. I had a close call early in the morning. I didn't set out a decoy, had one come through the neighbors and then come stand up on a little rise in this grassy fallow field. And it was just standing up there gobbling for like 10 minutes. And I wasn't tucked in very good to any cover. And so I did a couple calls after he came out and was kind of looking. And then I think he was kind of looking my direction and he didn't see a hen. So he kept gobbling, thinking maybe I can call the hen out, you know, or whatever. But I was like right there and I had my gun up and I just couldn't move. I felt like I was kind of pinned. So he moved off. And then later in the morning, I had a bird that crossed kind of a brushy fence line between another neighbor and he came out into the field. At that point, I set out a feeder hen decoy kind of facing me. And luckily it was facing like the way the bird came out, like from his perspective, the hen was walking away from him. So maybe he felt like he had to kind of catch up to her. And sure enough, he strutted all the way in from 200 yards and right at 30 yards, he slowed down and I gave him a little yelp with my mouth and got him right there. So yeah, it was a great first morning. Had that close call and then a couple hours later, had a bird on the ground. So, and then I had to hustle off to some family event. I can't remember what it was now, but I shot my turkey and I was like, I got to go. I think it was baseball. Like we had like a baseball scrimmage. And so I had no time to waste. I took a couple pictures, brought it back home and got it taken care of and everything. But so that was a really fun hunt. And then later in the year, I had fifth and sixth season. I didn't get out at all sixth. Fifth season, I had I had two evenings I got out. One evening, right as I was about to leave, or right as I left, I stood up and sure enough, I see just this bobbing red head behind a rise in the field, and it was coming in. I did some calling that evening, and I kind of know where they like to walk and roost, and it was like 7:30, and just felt like I needed to get back home and get kids to bed and wrap up the evening, you know, and I stood up and I took off. So it's like, what can you do? That's happened more times than I'd like to admit. But overall, yeah, like just a good turkey season. I mean, had some success and got one on the ground. And I always learn something every year about the birds up here where I hunt. And I think that's like the big thing for me is to just keep learning. I did track and field for many years in high school and then college as well at UW. And so I just never really had that turkey hunting experience where you just surround yourself with that animal behavior. Deer hunting, I've always been committed to that and like made the time for it. But with track being super busy in the spring, I could never do it. So now that I'm getting into my peak years of turkey hunting, I'm learning a lot every year. And this year was no different. So it was a ton of fun.
Totally. That's awesome, dude. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I didn't start turkey hunting until like right as I was wrapping up grad school. And I think that's a pretty dang fun addition to the hunting repertoire, I think. Like, especially like, I don't know, I don't think there's a bad time to start turkey hunting, honestly.
No.
But especially like once you're old enough to, you can go out, you can do it on your own. You can like make all those mistakes, you can run around. You've got the energy and the stamina.
Yeah.
Just put on the miles and chase gobbles and all that sort of stuff and figure it out. Like,
dude, man, 100%. It's been such a great change of pace. Like, you know, you can be mobile, don't have to be dead quiet until you get a bird. Like, at least in my spot, like I can see a long ways. So I know I can kind of move around and shift and whatnot. And just, it's a lot of fun, just a different change of pace and completely different from, you know, freezing tail off in a tree stand, being quiet, grinding dark to dark during the rut. I mean, that's just kind of how you have to deer hunt, at least me anyway. I'm not walking around still hunting and all that. I mean, I'm in a tree. That's just kind of my style. And that's how I can be successful in deer hunting. I'm not a good still hunter for whitetail, like mule deer and all that. That's kind of how you got to hunt them. And I love that style, but for whitetails, it's just not how I can hunt in hill country and not how I feel confident. So yeah, man, turkey hunting, it's been a lot of fun. I'm really getting into it. And just like learning about their behavior and a lot of the research that's out there has been super cool to read with like Dr. Mike Chamberlain and all that research that gets released through those turkey labs and stuff. It's just really cool. They're an amazing bird. And I just truthfully didn't know that much about them until really the last like 10 years, just learning more and more. So just a lot of respect for the animal and wanting to protect and conserve them. It's a lot of fun.
Definitely, dude. Yeah. I remember listening to like during COVID was actually when I started, when I went turkey hunting for the first time. And I remember listening to an episode of Meat Eater or something with Mike Chamberlain and him going through like the hat or the clutch success rates, like the hatch success rate. And then like of that, I think it was like 11%. And then of that 11% of, you know, successfully hatched poults, I want to say he said it was, and I could be butchering this here, so this is just what sticks in my mind, so don't quote me on this, folks. I want to say he said of that 11%, it was like 7% of them were toms. And I was just like, statistically, like, how do we have so many dang turkeys running around? Because this is insane. I'm sure that's like a national average, and I know that in Wisconsin, we're pretty dang fortunate in a lot of the state to have good turkey populations, but it just blew my mind. Like statistically, these things almost should not exist. Like what are the odds? It's crazy.
No, but super fragile. Yeah. Like really their populations over the course of like the last, you know, I don't know, ups and downs of, you know, 60, 70 years. I mean, it's just crazy. So yeah, we're seeing pretty good bird numbers in Southwest Wisconsin, whether it's been some springs that have helped with weather conditions, maybe people doing more predator control. Unfortunately, I'm like 3.5 hours away from my main property, you know, and there's just so much timber down in Southwest Wisconsin that my theory is there's more coons and possums and there's just more habitat in general. So that maybe contributes to more predator, like nest predators. Whereas up here in Northeast Wisconsin, there's a lot of big like farm country, and it's the habitat is more fragmented and just more farm fields with little woodlots everywhere. And my theory is there's just fewer coons and possums up here than there would be in Southwest Wisconsin. And so we have better bird numbers in Northeast Wisconsin than I do in Southwest Wisconsin for sure. But the numbers seem to be really good everywhere. So I think there's just more awareness too around what helps conserve turkeys and boost populations. And yeah, it's all awesome stuff.
Yeah, definitely. The predator control thing has always intrigued me. Cause like I grew up, I had extended family down in Iowa who were big, you know, coon hunters and ran dogs and stuff like that. And I mean, grandpa would fox hunt back then when there were still a bunch of fox running around, like a huntable population of them. And just like how ingrained into that generation's culture. Cause I'll still go down there and, you know, talk to people my grandparents' age or, you know, even just like a little bit, you know, older generation there who grew up doing it with their dads or whatever it is. And I mean, the stories they have of just throwing on the headlamp and letting the dogs run, and, you know, people didn't care about, you know, who was trespassing
property.
For the most part. It's not like today, exactly. It was just like, great, you're killing coons. Awesome. Go for it.
And, yeah, go. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. no cell cameras. No, it just was different back then. Yeah, it was
totally
different.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, it's the cell camera thing. I still go back and forth with, you know, I love them. They're an awesome tool, especially somebody who's, you know, been fortunate to hunt multiple states the last couple of years. Like I use the heck out of them. Yeah. On top of them, I'll even run one that just I keep up at my folks' place on year round, and just to see what's going on there. So I'll get fawns and see the turkeys do their thing and all that through the spring and the summer and everything. And like I've got a bachelor group of bucks on there right now that one of them looks way skinnier than I would like him to, but he's got really, really nice bases, it looks like. So I'm a little concerned about him. But, you know, it's just fun to like keep tabs on everything, and, you know, kind of it helps you stay connected to those areas. But at the same time, man, like I was on a trout stream last week, and granted, what, you know, it's private property, and, you know, we've got plenty of easemented sections and whatnot. But as I was going through this trout stream and I was down in the water and everything, I look across this pasture and I see just a big old rope scrape and a cell cam hanging there. I'm like, like, I don't think this thing's going to pick me up, but I still like, I don't want my picture taken while I'm trout fishing. And I don't know, the almost defensive manner in which cell cams are starting to be used is, and rightfully so. I mean, private property, do what you want with it, but definitely we're in just like a weird looking over like, your shoulder at all times kind of feeling era right now.
100%. It's just like cell phones and stuff. It's like, really? Mm-hmm. You got to have that? Like, you know, do we have to always have that out in front of our faces? Yeah. No, man, I hear you. And I think that's like one of the big things, like in Arizona, New Mexico, and some of those Western states on public land is why they, that's one of the reasons I think they banned them. Is because it's just like these people out hiking with kids and family and whatever, they walk past like what would be considered a hunting spot and they don't want their picture taken. Like, it's just like, I totally get it. Yeah. We're in an era where it's around every corner. There's like, I'm totally guilty of that. Obviously working for a cell cam company, like I got cameras on like stream crossings right off like a highway. And it's just like, and some of them I kind of hide, number one, just because I don't want people to see it. Number two, it's just almost like, I don't want people thinking, cause it's at my parents' property. I don't want my, you know, just people driving by to think like, oh, John and Kim, like really just, you know, want to see everything that's going on out there and have to like have a camera around every corner. Like, I don't want people thinking that about them, you know? And so, I hear you, man. It's I kind of feel the same way. We're in an era where it just, they're not going anywhere for sure. And it's just, I don't know. There's so much information out there. It's almost like it's kind of too much, but yet at the same time, we all love that info. Cause like you said, you love having that camera out on your parents' property or whatever. And just to see what's going on, like fawns and predators. And then you get a buck here and there, you get a bobcat or whatever it is. It's just, it keeps you connected to that land, you know? Like I set some cameras up purposely to get like a good expansive backdrop, so that I can see when like the corn is being picked on the neighbor's field way down in the valley, or I can see I don't know what the weather is that day, or if it's, I mean, I could look up the weather, but it's kind of cool to see like, oh yeah, it's cloudy at mom and dad's right now, and maybe it's going to rain and I should go have my dad, you know, put some seed down or whatever it is. It's just cool to be connected to the land so intimately through cameras. But yeah, and they're everywhere, and it's good and bad. I mean, we had I had a situation where I had a neighbor, well, kind of a neighbor, two properties away. He has a camera set up on like a little crossing easement that if like the neighbors don't walk perfectly on the easement, they technically walk on his land. And he was getting photos of them doing that and stuff. And it's like, and I get it, you know, he was kind of upset about it and just like, hey, these guys just bought the property and here they're not like sticking to the easement. And so he just sent them like a kind message saying like, hey, you know, just to let you know, like, this is my land, your easement is further down or whatever, try to stay on that, you know? And it's just like, mm-hmm. It creates situations that we would never know about and probably be better off, honestly, if we just yep. didn't know about it. You know, it's like, totally. I don't know. Yeah. Like when I was a kid, dude, we would run all over up in my parents' woods and dude, we for sure trespassed. Like there's no doubt about it. And, you know, Ken, Bob, Jim, Bill, whoever it is, they didn't care, you know, like it was mm-hmm. just, it wasn't the culture back then. And now it's like, I'm guilty of it. Yeah. I mean, I put in so much time and money and effort into like hunting that, I mean, yeah, if I get like somebody on camera, I just text them and be like, hey man, were you looking for a deer? Or, just making sure like nothing was going on where I can help. Like I text all the neighbors ahead of the season every year just to be like, hey, am I still good to go track a deer on your land? As long as I give you a call or shoot you a text, just don't want to get my picture taken and stuff. And it's just, you know, it creates that atmosphere too, where you feel like, yeah, you have to preemptively tell them like, hey, you know, might be on your land if you give me permission to get your deer. And then, you know, that's a good thing that you're getting ahead of it, which mm-hmm. I encourage a lot of people to do, but yeah, you're getting your picture taken around every corner, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think we're all such hypocrites too, right? Because I mean, here we are, you know, talking about the cons of it, but meanwhile, we're also using them and everything.
Yeah. And,
I don't know. But like, I'm sure you've heard it too. Well, there's different stuff going on, like this analyzation of this younger generation right now and how like these kids growing up with screens and how they behave differently. And I've, you know, talked to former college professors who are dealing with kids. And I was like, I talked to a guide client of mine. He teaches at UW. And he was like, well, I'd spoken with him about a conversation I had with a previous professor of mine who kind of said like, yeah, COVID really kind of did a number on these kids and everything. And I asked the same question to this gentleman from UW. And he was like, oh, it wasn't COVID. These kids are just like seemingly odd. Like for lack of a better term, like they are just odd. They're different because these kids who are in grad school grew up with the screen their entire life. Like they are, they're fully with it. And just the behavioral differences and, you know, the cultural shifts and, you know, it obviously translates to hunting as well, as you've got the people who are big, big tech users and, you know, want the, you know, just the style of hunting has changed completely. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think people have nearly as good of a pulse on their property or what's going on. Most people, I think, you know, as they think they do, I think they throw the cameras out and that's their pulse and it's just, you know, barely scraping the surface. But kids nowadays with like, they're constantly worrying about social media and, you know, the concern is like, how am I going to look? And it's going to change the way that they behave in social settings. And like, you know, about, not that it's a good or a bad thing that kids aren't drinking as much or anything, but like previous generations didn't have a bunch of cell phones or have to worry about getting their picture taken or anything like that. And it's totally different. And like, same with hunting, like nobody had to worry about. And I'm defending trespassing here, but we didn't have to worry about getting our picture taken and getting thrown on a Facebook message board. Does anybody know this jerk? He's, you know, been on my property 3 times.
Yeah.
And maybe it's something like you said, where it's just like, oh, I didn't realize the easement was here, not here. Sorry. Like, didn't mean to.
Yeah. And it creates, it's created like this sense of like, these are my deer. And this is like, these are the deer I'm chasing. And that protectiveness. The protectiveness of like, like, oh, that's my buck. Like, he's summered on my property all year, watched him grow in velvet. You know, he shifted over to your property and now, yep, your son, your 15-year-old son went and tracked a deer on our land during bow season. And now they're like majorly offended. You know, it's like, yeah, yep. It's created that my deer, your deer mentality, unfortunately. Like that part of it, I don't like at all. I don't.
Yeah.
Like, I hate that. And that is like, obviously, I mean, you go to trade shows and working for a cell cam company, like, I know it's just everybody's running them. And there's so many people that come up to me and say, like, oh, I have such a love-hate relationship with them because they love the info that they get and all that and the feedback that's instantaneous. But at the same time, everyone knows and everyone agrees it maybe has created like a hunting culture that we all sort of don't love at the same time.
Totally. Yeah, like, exactly.
For sure.
It's possessiveness, like you said there. Like, yeah, it's the, yeah. Which for one, if like, oh, that's my buck. Well, he was in my bean field all through August and September. And now your son shot him in late October on this hillside because you guys have all the doe bedding. Like, that was my buck. He was supposed to come back to my bean field. What's the matter with you? Like,
exactly.
Sorry, buddy. Like, do you have any idea how deer behave? Like, come on, dude.
Yeah. I know. And it's like, I felt kind of I fall guilty of it sometimes. Cause like there was a youth hunter last fall, close to my parents' property that, clipped a really nice 10 pointer that I was expecting to show back up on the property. And he did 2 days before that kid, hit him. And as soon as my dad called and said like, oh, you know, so-and-so is going to be walking over, you might get a picture of him. They're tracking a buck. And really supposedly a nice 10 pointer. I'm like, I know exactly what 10 pointer is. I know precisely what buck that is. And I was expecting it to show back up on the property and it did. And it, you know, the kid, unfortunately it wasn't a kill shot. And then a different neighbor, who I'm good friends with, he ended up killing him on Thanksgiving night during that first cold snap of the 9-day season. Nice. So, you know, it's just like, you know, everything about these deer, you know, their patterns, when they're going to show back up, you can like predict it within like 2 or 3 days of when they're going to show back up to a summer pattern or a fall pattern. And it's like, while it's awesome and you can know how to like prep your land and cater your property to a certain deer's needs, it's also like just so dangerous and like creates that like anxiety of like, at least it does for me being 3.5 hours away. Like, man, I got to get back there. I got to get back and hunt. Totally. And it's just like this, I should be focused on other things, you know? But at the same time, it is so cool because you get to see all the different things that show up and your food plot growth and like habitat projects you could put cameras near. I mean, it's like the feedback is, you know, it's priceless. So yeah, it's this constant battle for sure. But yeah, it's the day and age we live in, no doubt.
Totally. Yeah, dude, I caught myself. I got a picture of a doe with a fawn and I was like, what's the gestation period of a doe again? I like tried to backtrack because I was like, you know, people talk about, you just backtrack when that first fawn shows up or whatever. And I was like, October 29th or October 30th or something like that. You mean the deer hunting is going to be good in late October? I'm like, idiot. Yeah, right. Why did you just waste 5 minutes trying to like backtrack that? Like, you know how these properties behave. Yeah. You know the deer are going to pick up and start breeding in late October. Like, come on, you have better things to do with your time. But I really like what you said there, though, in terms of using cell cams to keep tabs on like the habitat status and like using them for what is the crop rotation this year? If you've got a property that's out of state, you're not sure. I mean, usually if you're going there and throwing summer trail cams out, you're going to know if it's beans or corn, but when are they picking? You know, what's like the leaf cover even in the timber and everything? Like, have the leaves dropped off the, you know, whatever it may be? Like, is it wide open all of a sudden? And being able to keep 100%. Tabs on stuff like that, dude, that's a really, really great, I think, overlooked tip and like use for cell cams, dude. That's awesome.
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick sec to tell you about Lone Wolf Custom Gear. Lone Wolf Custom Gear is as good as it gets when it comes to mobile hunting equipment. Whether you're a saddle or stand guy, public land or private, Lone Wolf Custom Gear has a set of sticks, a stand, a camera arm, and any number of accessories to get you closer to your target buck. To make it even better, everything is 100% USA sourced and made right here in the Midwest. And it's even assembled right across the river in Iowa by hunters who love chasing deer just as much as you do. To build your kit today, go visit lonewolfcustomgear.com. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Are there any other, like, whether it be cell cam things or like, I'm kind of been like thinking about just, and there's so many things that like hunters can get wrapped up in. And like, it's almost like we reach this point of like paralysis by analysis in some sense. Like you read a lot of articles, you know, on deer hunting and, you know, deer culture. And you and I have been talking about deer culture a fair bit recently. Like, what are some things that you think a lot of people just get like wrapped up in that eat more time and keep them off of deer more than getting them into deer?
Yeah, I think a couple things, like I've written about this a little bit, is like making drastic changes to the land without like first actually having a good grasp on what the natural movement is. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, that's been something I've been like more focused on, is like, if I get like a new permission property, like, and I have permission to make some changes with the habitat, is like, get a lay of the land first and see how you can like make drastic changes to play off of that. Don't just like, in my mind, like, don't just show up and like make quote unquote 60 year mistakes by cutting timber and doing all these things that could possibly screw up a good thing that you could have complemented if you had, you just waited like one or two seasons to see patterns of how deer are moving. And that's where just like stand time, and I mean, let's be honest, running some cameras, like, we'll give you a little bit of data in terms of like, man, deer are doing this. Like, I could easily go out and clear some junk trees off this like little hillside where they already bed and complement that spot even more. And then around this corner, I could like cut out a little food plot in this opening and probably get in clean, like all that stuff that just, if I ever bought like property, that's what I would do, is just show up and hunt for like the first two seasons, get the lay of the land, and then go from there in terms of like implementing changes. And then I think like just getting wrapped up in, like, it's about that time of year where you and I and everybody else is going to get really wrapped up in summer scouting, and we're going to like put way too much, way too much like thought and just like bank a lot of our effort into that. And it's, some of it's not going to matter at all come fall. Like, that's where I like, I like write down reminders to myself, like while I'm sitting in the tree stand, is that like every fall I'm seeing this pattern, and that I think I can like do something in the summer to like either enhance what they're already doing, or I can work, like, I think I can just somehow work harder in the summer to make it better. And it's like, no, like, you just sometimes have to just show up and like hunt and like not overthink it. Like, there is that portion to hunting, is like just not addressing the actual needs of the property, not being like in tune with whether your property needs more food or cover. That's another thing that's like huge, I think, is like people are like, oh, geez, I bought this new property, or yeah, I finally got permission to hunt on my uncle's land or whatever it is. And you're seeing all these awesome deer in the summer, and then the leaves fall off and the cover, and all that changes drastically, and so do the deer habits. And like just not addressing the needs of the land and kind of being like on the forefront of knowing like, okay, like I got some food on this property, but the timber is, you know, it looks like a park. There's not much water here. That should be like a red light to be like, all right, well, we got to fill the lowest hole in the bucket. Like just not being like in tune with your property and kind of knowing how things could look come late October and early November. It just changes everything, like leaf off does. Like we have a big valley where we have a food plot, and it's really good early season. It kind of like takes it's this big long field off the road, and then it kind of takes a dog leg to the right, and it's like tucked away from the road. You can't see it, but it's this big open valley that's like 3 or 4 acres. And on every side, there's big hills that pour down into it. So it's like this awesome thermal hub in the evenings. Mm-hmm. And when the leaves are on, the deer love it. They pile out like crazy. But for late season, man, when leaf off happens, it's just like not the same spot. And my theory is that deer feel really exposed down in that valley. Sure. And I've tried to hunt it. I've tried to like plant food, and like, sure, you'll get like daylight buck photos down there. Don't get me wrong, but it's just like, they don't like to hang out down there. It's never quick. All right. It's never like a long time where they're down there feeding. It's always like really fast and quick. And sure. So like what I've done is kind of almost give up on that spot a little bit. Number one, because the access is terrible. I have to walk through, a big valley field with hills and ridges everywhere on my way to the stand back there or to the blind. So number one, the access isn't very good. Number two, the deer don't really like to spend much time back there after leaf off anyway. And so kind of knowing that and like understanding like how the farm lays out and the deer desires and needs during the rut, I kind of play off that and hunt the ridges that are easier to access closer to the road and kind of play off that and hope that deer traffic is kind of filtering back at some point, try to catch them that way. So I think just like knowing how things are going to look during the fall is something that a lot of hunters get wrong. And we all love setting cameras out for deer in the summer, and they're just so carefree throughout all the months of June, July, and August. Like August, I think, is when deer are most visible, like bucks. Like they're August, like 1st through the 20th is like, I think that's when bucks are like out in full force. Like some of my biggest velvet buck photos are during August. And then all of a sudden, I mean, they shed velvet and like the brain cells develop. Like it's just the way it is. And then they're ghosts and you're like, what happened? You know, and the soybeans start to yellow. That's another thing. A lot of like when I was a younger hunter, I was like, oh my gosh, this soybean field is going to be just awesome come, you know, third week of September for Wisconsin and all that. And then the soybeans are all yellow for the most part because it's farmer soybeans, you know? Yep. So just like that easy stuff where veteran hunters just kind of like, you kind of remember that stuff or you write it down, you see it from year to year and you just don't get like fooled. It's almost like it'd be like the Cleveland Browns starting out 6-0 during a season and just kind of getting lucky. And you're just like, well, no, that's just not like how they are. They're going to like go, you know, 7-10 or whatever and miss the playoffs. It's like that in the summer with like deer. It's like they kind of fool you to the point where you're like, man, this giant, he's like coming out and it's like July. You know, and it's just most of the listeners on this podcast probably already know that, but just we all get wrapped up in that. And I try and like if I have a giant on camera during the summer, I just don't really care that much anymore. Like it's cool to see. And he might be around. But like I know the DNA of some of the properties I hunt where I truly know they shift off. And if I can't control the habitat on that property, probably gonna lose that deer. And yeah, he might come through during the rut, but you know, just to be aware of some of that stuff. And I think like if we want to get into like new landowners or people who are hunting permission farms where they have like truly the control and ability to like enroll in like government programs or something like that. Like that's another thing if I ever own property, I would be pretty patient with in like not enrolling in some government programs right away to see number one, what I want to do to the property without any limitations. And then number two, get an idea on, hey, I want to do this project and actually there's cost sharing that can allow for that. So just like stuff like that, where just you don't always think of it, but just being patient with some of that stuff and really making sure you make like an informed decision that's not going to like hurt your ability to do what you want to do on the property. Is something I think that like people just jump into right away and they see a lot of these habitat managers and stuff on YouTube saying this and that. And it's like, I think you just got to like take a deep breath and just be like, all right, what are my goals? And like, how can any of these habitat improvements get me to where I want to go, whether that be through government programs or some of my own work or whatever that looks like. So, and then another thing too, I kind of made a little bit of a list here, is thinking that you can't like do a lot of these habitat projects or implement a food plot without like big equipment. Like that is one of the like biggest lies out there. Like we see all these ads for, you know, this no-till drill or this chainsaw or this new habitat tool or trick. Man, like so much can be done with like a backpack sprayer, a weed whacker, and a hand seeder and like a hand saw. Like, dude, I've made this awesome little kill plot that I've posted about on my Instagram page quite a bit and kind of shown, like if people scroll down, they can kind of see from beginning to end how I like created it and cut a bunch of brush out and stuff. And it's just like a cool little food plot and it's not even a quarter acre, but I did it all with like a Heumann pole saw and then like one of those just fold out hand saws to like get the stumps down even further on just these little junk, junk trees like ironwood and all sorts of other stuff that I cleared out. And like, I've also planted like a half acre brassica and alfalfa plot that my first my son killed his first deer over last year, and I did it all by hand. Like just stuff like that where it's like, man, if there's like areas you want to plant, like you don't need a tiller, a brush mower, no-till drill, a tractor. You really don't. Like I weed whacked a half acre food plot last year over the course of four different weekends. So yes, a ton of work, a ton, but there was no way to get equipment down there with the way some neighbors have some stuff arranged with like sheds and the property lines and stuff like that. I can't get any big equipment down there at all. So it's a big fallow field, and I just created this kill plot. And so just thinking that you need all this huge, heavy equipment is like one of the big lies of like the hunting industry. So much can be done with just hand tools.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to be able to do it. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the analogy of you want to be using a scalpel, not a chainsaw for certain jobs too, right? Like you don't need to have that big, be able to drive your truck all the way down this trail to that thing. I mean, deer, for the most part, you know, we look at a deer trail, it's only about shoulder width. It's not some big wide highway bombing through the woods where they're just going to stroll down it like we are. Like they don't think like that. They don't behave like that. That's such a great tip, man. And even like, I mean, like you said, the handsaw, the chainsaw, the weed whacker, stuff like that, stuff that's probably hanging in most people's garage. I mean, you can do a lot of stuff like that. And, you know, yeah, like you could hinge cut, but you also like, say you just cut off a bunch of branches because you're trimming shooting lanes or something. Like, what if you just piled up that brush to kind of make deer work around it that way rather than having to go in and, you know, do those, you know, potentially, like you said, those 60 year, you know, recovery projects, you know, if you do it wrong. And, you know, one of the things you said there, aside from, I need to touch on the Browns analogy because that was absolutely spot on. And I think we've all had our, target buck blows ACL midway through the season and be just gone. So, but dude, like the a lot of what you just said there was like, it's so, I mean, just minor changes in like the habitat. Like you said, the leaves falling off, or the ag being cut, whatever it may be. It's stuff that happens year round, but it makes such a massive difference in how the deer move and where they feel secure and, you know, the way they like to do things. And, you know, I really like what you said there too about how starting the year or giving a property, especially if it's new, like 1 or 2 years to kind of develop so you can really get a feel for like, okay, this is how the deer use it. This is like where my time is going to be better spent. And I think it's kind of like the, you know, the best hunters scout more than they hunt, right? Like we're scouting not just for that deer, but we're also scouting for the entire property and what the future of that's going to look like, right? And, you know, I mean, I had a farm that I was hunting last year that had a bunch of big bucks, but guess what? They lived in standing corn that wasn't picked until November 2nd. And at that point, it was just a crapshoot, and I was, you know, starting to panic about my rut slipping away and everything. And, you know, those bucks would show up every night on camera, but it was down in the creek bottom, and they showed up at 9 p.m. or, you know, just after dark. Like, I never had a single daylight picture of them. So then trying to zoom out of that, you've just got a sea of corn, a sea of ag. Like, okay, I realized very quickly that there's good deer in there, but after throwing a bunch of sits on it, it wasn't really worth the time to, you know, try and figure out and backtrack and everything. You're better off to just pick up, especially on limited time, pick up and find a better spot that's going to hopefully produce quicker. And like a lot of these things, like you said, are people look for the easy way or the quick fix. You know, they see all these YouTube, you know, land managers and stuff, and they think to themselves, like, oh, well, I need to hinge cut. Like, the bedding must suck in here. Like, I need to hinge cut and create bedding. Like, well, there may have already just been bedding on the next point over or just in a different area that you didn't realize. And, you know, you might be trying to create habitat where you don't need it. Like, you might be creating it there and then your access suck. Whereas they were bedding, you know, perfectly fine in some weird little draw in between two cattle pastures or some CRP that just because it didn't look like what we see on YouTube or what we see on TV or, you know, in social media, whatever it is, because it didn't look like that, we think there's something wrong with it or it can't be right.
Yeah.
And taking the time to figure that stuff out is, I mean, that pays dividends down the road and saves you a heck of a lot of work too on top of it. But I like, like you said there too about the beans. Like, oh yeah, in Wisconsin, our beans, if they're a farmer's beans, they're brown by September. Yet everybody sees the videos of guys, you know, that big, crazy, you know, 2 foot wide blood trail, just painting these green soybeans and everything. It's like, well, that was a patch of beans that was planted much later than what the farmer did. And nobody tells you that. Nobody, you know, keys in on that. And it's like, oh, well, they're in a picked cornfield. Yeah, that wasn't a picked cornfield. That was a mowed cornfield. Like, come on, let's look in a little bit deeper than that. But do you do? What do you do?
And one thing, like, too, going back to cameras, like, a little bit, and just like hunting a property over and over again, something that I've picked up on is like, whatever, like, so we have a property that's like split by a road. It's all contiguous, but it's split by a road. And one side of the road has basically one deer herd and the other side has another. It's kind of cool. It's, and it's weird how they don't like cross the road that often. But on one side of the road, whatever big buck is over there, we kind of like know. Like, not that they just run in like circles and like do that during the rut, but it's kind of like that a little bit. And like, you can, like, last year I had a close call with what I think was like one of the most mature bucks on like that side of the road. And he caught me climbing up into my tree for my second ever saddle hunt, and I couldn't get my arrow knocked in time, but he was under my tree at 25 yards and I would have had him had I just got set up 10 minutes sooner. He'd be dead, but I think he would be anyway. But anyway, like, whatever big deer, whether it's him or a different one this year, that's going to be back on that side of the road, like, they just repeat. And like, they kind of like, if I would have killed that one, whichever big one is going to show up this year would have filled in kind of that pattern. It's the craziest thing. So on that side of the road, we don't lose bucks to a fall shift, and whatever mature deer is over there kind of follows what the previous mature deer did on that same side. It's the weirdest thing. And like, it's, dude, it's just held true. Yeah, it's held true for like the last 7 to 8 years since I've been running cell cams like really heavily. And so I can just basically, like, truthfully, I would never really need to run cameras over there again, because I kind of know like what the deer are going to do. It's just a big ridge system of like 4 or 5 different ridges. And I kind of know that, like, when I'm over there during late October, or early November, like, I'm in the game. Like, I am in the game. Even if I don't have them on camera like that often, like, I know they're going to come through. It's like, it's a property that just holds deer in the fall. I think number one, because of like a visibility standpoint, the deer bedding just off the ridge can see down into the valleys, and they can see us approaching tree stands too, unfortunately. But if they're in certain other areas, and you get in clean, man, like, hold tight, because they're there, like, they're close. Like, that's the one thing too, like, with cameras, it just gives you that promise and that knowledge that, like, and these deer are like right here, like, they're close. Even when things are dead and the rut is like rocking 2 miles away, your buddy's texting you, or he just slayed his giant, whatever it is, like, it's going to break loose and the deer are close, and you just have to grind it out. Like, that's one thing. It's just like, if you can, like, just keep going and keep going and going and going. That's the only way I know how to kill deer, is to just keep hitting those high percentage spots during high percentage days to try to get those encounters. And like, that's all you can do, is like, parse it down to, this is a good spot and it's a good day to hunt. The weather is there. They've been showing. And that's all you can do, is just plop your butt in a tree stand and just wait them out and do the best you can. Like, that's how I know how to hunt. And, but just like picking up on little things like that, like specific deer behavior on specific properties, and kind of knowing generally like what they do, it can help you. And like, I guess the devil's advocate to that would be like, it can also hurt you too. If you just keep hunting those same spots over and over again, like, there is that, like, geez, you got to change things up and like surprise them a little bit in some of these locations. Like, there is something to that for sure. But I don't know. I got spots that I've analyzed and scouted and hunted, and I kind of got like those 7 to 8 spots where it's like, man, this is like November 5th, sit right here. And if you don't see something, November 6th, sit right here. And then November 7th, like, you're going to get your shot at something, you know, like, something is going to run by. like I, the more I hunt, the more I kind of do adhere to like that theory of, and just keep marching right back to that stand. Like just keep, something's going to come by. If you got the wind and you got the weather and all those other factors lined up and you know, it's just that, that money spot. Like I would tell people sometimes like, don't overthink it. I mean, it's fun to stay mobile. But if you got a private property that's dialed in and you know, the deer, I mean, you kind of got it made and you just got to keep going during high percentage days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dude, I think we're told a lot because if you just keep going, that doesn't really sell much hunting product, right? Like we're always being told that there's like, you should fix this. Like, well, don't fix what isn't broken. You know what I mean? Like, I've got the same kind of thing where, you know, we do have deer cross the road by my folks' place, but it's, you've got these two different herds and on, you know, I guess there's sort of three doe groups that bed, you know, kind of around. We have kind of the hub on our end, and then we have a bunch of really good bedding across the road on the neighbors. And if it's a south wind, they run the loop this way. If it's a north wind, they run the loop that way. But those bucks, like as soon as the rut starts heating up and that pre-rut starts kicking off, dude, it's like you can, you know, this is the point you need to be on. This is where they're going to cross through. And like you've got those areas where like, like it's kind of a toss up of whether or not he's going to go right down that trail. But for the most part, they're going to be moving within 50 yards of, you know, a couple of these pinch points on that loop. And if you can figure that out, like, don't overthink it. Just need to get your butt in the stand.
It's like a, I mean, it's like a football play, you know, like the Seattle Seahawks and Patriots Super Bowl back in the day where they should have gave the ball to Marshawn Lynch on the 2 yard line and said Russell Wilson threw a pick. It's like, well, it's kind of that same thing. Like sometimes just make the move you think you should move. Don't overthink it. Like just keep going to those same things that are working for you. Like, I mean, it's fun to like change things up and like sit a different stand for the scenery or like to try to learn something new. Like I'm not saying that's like a bad thing at all. Mm-hmm. Like I have a couple spots like that, that I really want to sit, but I know, or I think they're a little bit lower percentage spots, but I really want to sit them to kind of like find out, but I just don't have like the time and the days to be able to kind of waste, you know, or try to maybe waste and do that. So yeah, it's just like, man, and you're right. Like it doesn't sell hunting gear. Like that thought of just, just keep marching back to that, you know, 21-foot ladder stand that you and your dad set up. Like that probably could be the best spot on the farm, but like, you know, getting mobile sticks and all this other gear and trying to hunt this different cool spot that sells gear. And yeah, it's fun to hunt new areas and whatnot, but might not be the best choice. And so that's where it's just that summer scouting. And then especially, well, I should say spring and summer scouting. Spring is kind of where it's at with me, like February and March are the big scouting months. Summer can be if you're still kind of learning a farm, but and then just hunt and then scout more than you hunt if it's a property that you're still trying to learn throughout the fall. Like if you're out there scouting in September and parts of October, even mid-October, man, I mean, I don't know. I don't think you're going to spook deer out of the county. I don't think you're going to spook them out of the county. Like there's been tons of research that shows like those deer, yes, they might be a little more wary and like move a little bit more on the edge of the daylight, but they're not going anywhere. Like they're not, you're not spooking them way off the property. You're not doing that. Like most research has shown that. And so they'll be back, like dive in there and run around and do your scouting. Like you know, whether you do it on a UTV or a e-bike or there's whatever, whatever the deer are used.
Chainsaw, something that, you know, it doesn't seem like you.
Tractor, you know, tractor. Like Bill Winky's done a bunch of episodes where he like drove into his hunting spot on a tractor because the deer are used to it. You know, it's like, I don't know. I think we put too much stock into that sometimes too. Give deer a little bit too much credit sometimes. And then in other areas we don't think like they do and we don't give them enough credit, you know. That's what makes it such a fun game and so tough. It's like when you kill a deer, man, it's something to be celebrated because there's just so many things we don't understand that we think we do, and that's what makes it awesome.
Definitely. Well, and it's so much fun too, because I mean, if you're somebody who hunts public and private, like it's just two totally different headspaces to be in. Right. Like, nobody's driving their truck or, you know, I think most of us can relate to like you pull up to that private lot or the public lot, excuse me. And like, we've all thought like, maybe I should just park further down the road and like walk in. So there's no like gravel popping while I drive down to this spot. If there's a weird road to get down there, or like shutting the door quietly or whatever it is, just to try and like give the illusion that like, oh, well, like as long as they don't hear me slam my door, maybe that'll just put some slight, you know, stack of cards in my favor or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, yeah, these deer, like you said, like they don't go anywhere. They bed in these spots for a reason. And I think like the only way that you're really going to kick them out is if you kill one in that spot or wound one like in their bed, or you sneak up on them so good that you just scare the absolute crap out of them. And they're like, oh my gosh, the spot isn't as good as I thought it was. And, you know, then they're, then you just educated them a little bit. But I think, you know, if you're, I mean, I do it a lot on public too. I'll walk like a main trail. I'll walk it like loud. I don't care. I will literally walk it loud. Or, you know, in this one river bottom piece where there's a bunch of duck hunters, like headlamp is on. I'm walking the fringes just like everybody else. And, you know, giving the illusion that I'm a duck hunter. And until I'm close to where I want to get, then I kill the light. Then I get quiet. Then I try and slip into a tree where I know I need to be. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, make all the noise over there so they think the noise is over there. And you can do the same thing on private, right? Like, I mean, like you said, going with the UTV or the tractor, whatever they are conditioned to respond to or survive despite, that's what we need to be trying to imitate if we're, you know, trying to get in and do that stuff. How did you like running the saddle on private this year? And being able to kind of have that little bit of leeway, because it's like a slippery slope, right? You can almost get too mobile where it's like, well, I could go down there. Why wouldn't I? I've got this saddle now. Or you fall back and you're like, well, I could bring the saddle in, but I know this stand's produced for me in the past. Like, what was the balance of that like for you this year?
Dude, it was a ton of fun. I only hunted out of it 4 or 5 times. But so the hunt I was referring to where I had that deer come through at like 25 yards when I wasn't settled in quite yet, it was only 10 yards behind a traditional hang-on set that's a really good spot. I just needed to change something. Like how I sat in the tree is all I needed to change. I just wanted a different style. Like that's it. I just wanted to like give this a go and be like, you know what? Like I just need to look at a tree in a set of woods in a different light and like just do something different. And it was super refreshing. It was awesome. So I think I'm gonna really love it. Like I haven't made the decision yet if I want to like tear down some hang-on stands and then just leave some sticks up and then take my saddle and platform and just hunt out of that area. I haven't really made that decision yet of what I want to do, but I'm gonna love it. Like I really like the ability to swing around the tree and hide. Like that deer had no idea I was there. And I was like swinging around the tree as he's coming, like trying to get my bow pulled up number one and like get my release on because I didn't want it clanking because it was only my second or third saddle hunt. So I didn't want any extra noise. So I think the ability for me to hide behind the tree and just look like something different up there is going to be huge for my parents' property where I mainly hunt. Like just something different where I can, man, those does out there are like super wary and like they'll bust you. Like I don't really ever get busted by bucks out there, and it's not because I'm a good hunter. It's just literally because I hunt mainly during the rut now with like kids commitments and stuff. I just show up and kind of do my rut hunting. Unfortunately, I wish I could get out there more during early season, but and they're always just preoccupied. I don't know what it is. Like I've been lucky to not like get busted by many bucks. It's usually, I mean, I get busted by does. They ruin 4 to 5 hunts a year for me, minimum. So I think honestly, like beating the eyes of does has been like the number one factor that I've like seen so far, is to just get at a height in the tree where you have some cover and face the area where you want them coming through and move and swivel around the tree. Like it's been huge. I got the, can't remember the Predator V. Platform, I think from Tethered, really like it. So those guys over there have like done an awesome job, like all sorts of other brands too, like create some awesome saddle hunting products. And so I think I'm going to utilize it a lot for private land. I'm super excited to keep perfecting like my my timeliness of like getting in there and like getting settled pretty quick, and just like some cool areas that like some gnarly trees right off like field edges that are like small, and you would never be able to get anything else in there, but you can get up 4 or 5 feet with a saddle.
Yep.
And like find a little window in the branches to make a shot. Like, dude, you talk about like surprising deer. Like that's the stuff that I'm excited to do, is just totally get into these nooks and crannies of the properties that I hunt that I've never been able to like open my eyes to, because I haven't really had the equipment to like, okay, well, I can't hunt that tree because of the way it leans and the way it looks and all these branches. But with saddle here, like it changes the game completely.
Big time. Yeah, dude. I'm sure you've noticed too, like with those does, like I would wager a pretty good bet that those does probably are fairly keyed into where some of those historic ladder stands are. And I would imagine if they're anything like the does around my folks' place, they might come up the hill and they might just peek up into that tree just to make sure every time they go in there, just to make sure that nobody's sitting up there and
yeah,
that they don't have to worry. So if you can do that kind of thing where it, and also too, like moving to a tree that's 6 feet away, that might be like, you know, just in front of where that ladder stand was, or just behind it, or, you know, adjacent to it, whatever. And just taking a different angle on a pre-existing setup that you've hunted for years and you've got a bunch of historical, you know, intel with, and you know how the deer like to use it and hunt, you know, move through it and everything. Like, dude, just be able to give yourself a different angle, a different perspective. Like,
yeah,
it opens your eyes to so much more. Like, I've learned a ton through doing mobile or running mobile setups on my folks' property and just bouncing around, you know, within a 20-yard bubble of that stand and being like, oh wow, I can see all the way down this ridge if I move, you know, 10 yards up the hill and I'm in this spot, or I can, you know, do whatever. And it's just it's mind-blowing, not to mention, like you said, those lower, almost more like kind of dicey, risky trees that you used to, like, you would have previously written off. And it's like, wait, I can get in that now, and I can be basically level with this deer, yet be almost completely concealed. Like, that's the exciting stuff.
Pretty cool. Yeah. And like playing the thermals a little bit more too. Like the thermal game is huge for me. Those does at my parents know how to use the thermals to a T. Like they can get in certain areas of like field edges and scent check the entire woods above them. And they do that right before first light, where the thermals are still dropping downhill and collecting into those thermal hubs. They swing downwind, or not downwind, I guess, down where the thermals are pooling to catch anything that's in the woods already. Like, it's incredible. And they're so good at that. And then like, if you expect a certain deer to come through, or even does to come through at a certain time, you can position yourself to where your thermals are going to like dump down into a certain area, like before they come through, or after they come through, or whatever you need to do, or the rising thermals. You can just position yourself a little bit better with like a saddle, and you don't have to move a hang on or a ladder stand that's been there forever. It might be a good spot for like 9-day gun season or something, but you're like, man, for this bow hunt, like the wind is going to be doing this today. The thermals aren't going to rise till, you know, 8:30 in the morning or whatever. Like, I got to go back tonight and like get my saddle gear ready. And then the next morning you make that little shift and you might like see that success, and it opens up just like your whole new perspective on like, man, I got to like play this game a little bit more. So like, that's where I think saddle hunting is going to come into play for me, is just making those super, super subtle changes that are going to add up to hopefully like just more tags being punched and like just nailing down those details.
Definitely. Dude, I love that, man. That's one of the things you learn pretty dang quick. Like, if you're going to start mobile hunting, like, you're going to learn how thermals work really, really quickly. And if you don't, you're going to struggle. And
especially in hill country. In hill country, man, it's just brutal. Like, it is crazy. Like, that's what they're playing off of. Like, the wind direction, like, yes, I pay attention to the wind, man, but like the last, you know, hour, even 15, 10 minutes of daylight, like, you better know what those thermals are doing, because those bucks and those old does, they're going to be using it, and they know how to position their nose. Like, they just do. And I personally, it's just really hard to beat a deer's nose. You can use all the products you want. Like, some products help for sure, no doubt. But man, if the thermals are falling into a deer's nose, like, they're going to get you. They just are. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Not to mention just all the nooks and crannies that Hill Country provides for them to sit and like basically have, I mean, some of them, it's almost like they have a consistent thermal pull the entire time where they'll sit down in this bottom of this one weird little shady draw and just catch everything that falls down there on that north slope or whatever it may be. And
yeah, it creates crazy spots. Yeah, it creates spots that you really can't hunt. Like Bill Winky's also talked about that. Like I know I've referred to him already, but man, I really follow a lot of his stuff. And he's talked so much over the course of like the years that he's been writing and doing content about spots that just like aren't huntable. And I truly think that there are some locations that are just great spots for the deer, but they're terrible for a deer hunter. Like you can't get in there, or while you're in there, the wind is doing this and the thermals are doing that. And it just, you're kind of wasting your time. Like you might see some yearlings or some fawns, but like, man, those bigger deer, they're just in does, mature does. They're going to catch up on that and pick you off. And it's just, man, you might see them, but they get into range and the wind's doing this, thermals, all that stuff. They're going to get you.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, I've started to lean away from the bed hunting, or like the bedding area hunting, a fair bit over the last year or so, just as I started to realize, especially on that new property that I was on last year, just the amount of damage that I was doing, which normally I'm okay with blowing up a property and pushing deer around and kind of just figuring things out in that regard. But I mean, at this point, like I just started getting to a point where I was like, every time I go in here, like I'm blowing something out like this. I'm starting to accept the fact that this might actually not be a huntable system here. Like it's kind of a weird north facing slope with a kind of like a, it's not even like a bluff, it's a bluff, but it's like maybe 30 feet high. Like it's not a big bluff whatsoever, but those deer can sit up on top of that thing and just see everything. Like they can see 600 yards from on this bluff, and it's just insane. I'm like, there's no way I'm getting in here. There's absolutely no way I'm getting in here. And
no,
there's plenty of sign. There's some nasty rubs in there, but I'm not.
How do you get in
there?
Exactly. This year we went to an area on a big point that just dumps off, and it's deer just love to bed up there. And there's so many beds. And I told my dad to go like stand where we have like a tree stand, and I'm gonna like get down at deer level and kind of see what I can see. And man, they can see forever. So it's just one of those spots that I'm kind of having to like reconsider. Like, man, how do I do this? Like, how can I get in here without these does picking me off? And like one thing I've been doing more and more is like putting cell cams in an area where you get a picture, like potentially like in a bedding area, maybe not, but just like get a picture in an area where you can play off of that, where if you know a deer is here, like the next morning or later that day, you can be, like deciding, okay, like I'm going to go to this general area because I know if I get a picture here, sometimes they come through this way or whatever. Like you can play off of that some, right? So there's that game you can play. And it's also, and then also you have like the mental game of like, how ethical is this? And do you really want to be using like that information? Like, so there's that too, like setting your delays to 12 hours or send time. So once per day, like all that stuff. So yeah, there's so many different things you can do and play around with and whatnot, but that's something else I've been doing is like getting cameras more like right on those like bedding ridge points to where it's like, okay, I got a picture here. Could have moved off down like into this valley or around the corner. So if I sit like around that corner, maybe they're moving off down towards the egg field, towards dark, you know, all that stuff. It's just that cat and mouse game.
Yep, absolutely. Do you think we're headed towards regulation with cell cams and stuff like that? Just all the different technology in hunting?
I think there could be. I think there'd be some major uproar from like hunting groups and stuff. But then there's some hunting groups that would be for it, I think, too.
Right.
So I go back and forth on that one. I think at some point I wouldn't be surprised if there's regulation on transmission times, how often they send, all that stuff. But I know so many government and like organizations that use them. And so they don't want to like handcuff themselves either. You know what I mean? There's so much, there would have to be so much customization inside the cameras, I think, for that to happen. But Yeah. The Midwest is a different beast than like Arizona, Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, all those regulations out west. It's just a different style of hunting out there, right? Like,
yep.
I don't need any cameras to go kill a mule deer or anything like that. It just doesn't really help. That's just not how you hunt out there necessarily.
Right. Yeah.
But with whitetails and
percentage of public land in those states or that, yeah, you know, those states consist of, it's, yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if in 10 years there's some regulations that manufacturers would have to like go off of, but it wouldn't surprise me if like there's major uproar in some of these big whitetail states where people are like, no, you're not gonna regulate that stuff because it's a slippery slope into regulating other ways of like the hunting life, I guess.
Totally. Yeah. Especially, yeah, with some of the bills that we've seen out west and everything, I think.
Yeah, the Oregon deal.
Dude, I mean, how did that get enough traction? That's wild.
That is like radical. That's insane.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy. So like people better be like voicing their opinions about that, because like that stuff just can't happen. Like,
yeah,
it just can't. Like, if we're truly about this lifestyle and protecting it, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. I think everybody saw that and they were like, there's no way there's enough traction to get that into a bill. And yet here we are. So what do you do?
Yeah. But there's going to be those threats all the time, like to public land, or even smaller threats about certain areas and small regulations that, you know, feed into bigger things that people attack. Like, there's always going to be that. But that Oregon deal is like, that's a scary one.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just, you don't know. Yeah. So we all got to stand up and just, nip that stuff in the bud right away, and just like always put ourselves like in a good light, you know, with non-hunters. Like, I try to do that so much in like public. If I'm like wearing some camo or like I have a hunting logo anywhere like on my body, like I'm not like I'm going over the top, but like I'm holding doors for people or whatever, you know, and just being like extra, like, oh yeah, yeah, thank you, you're welcome, whatever, just be like extra kind, right? Like, why not?
For sure.
Like, you know, put our lifestyle out there in like a good light with like the general public. So I'm always trying to do that. And like, that stuff matters. Like, it really does. So it doesn't have to be crazy over the top stuff.
Yeah. Not to mention too, it's, you know, folks, they remember the bad more than they remember the good. Right. So it's like making sure that there's always more good than bad out there is, definitely going to pay dividends down the road for us, hopefully. I just worry about this upcoming generation and just the care that, and the connection that some of these kids are having to the outdoors, and, you know, getting them outside and getting them engaged with like the real stuff that, you know, is actually alive and living. And just, I don't know, it's like anything, right? It's like we were talking about turkeys. We started this conversation talking about, you know, I had no idea that there was this much that went into turkeys, that they were up against this many challenges, and now I do. I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever. And I don't know, my favorite part of guide trips is always when I'll flip a rock and I'll show somebody who's never been fly fishing, like, check out all these different bugs that are on here, like, here's what's going on here and all that. And they're like, I'm like, that's just one rock. Like,
yeah,
you catch a good hatch and I mean there's thousands of bugs in the air, and there's hundreds of trout, just, you know, all these different, you know, little dimples and ripples and everything going all the way up the stream. And it's just, it's the coolest thing. And there's all this life that you'd have no idea was there otherwise if you never.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, my brother's been getting into like birding more and more. Dude, and like that's become kind of popular, you know. Like, dude, the Merlin app or whatever that is. Like it's a Merlin app. Yeah, like that's fun. Like when you're out turkey hunting, to like turn that on and see what you have around, like birds are like, that might be like my next thing, is like learning about like conservation of like all these birds, that, you know, their migration patterns and like all that stuff is just incredibly fascinating. Like,
definitely.
And what that means to like the greater ecosystem of like just the forests in Wisconsin or Iowa or whatever it is, like, it's pretty amazing. Like, and all that stuff like is pretty fragile when you think about it.
Well, dude, and just like, I mean, the distance these birds cover, like, I think I talked with, who was I talking with last year? I apologize to whoever it was. I'll remember it as soon as we stop recording, I'm sure.
Yeah, right.
But we were talking about the banding program for blue-winged teal, and they tracked bird that they banded in, I don't know, like Horicon Marsh or something like that, and tracked it, and I think it was in like 8 weeks or something like that. Some might have been shorter than that. He traveled like all the way down to like southern Brazil or like Argentina or something. It's like, that's insane. Like these, you know, goofy little ducks that we see in the Madison parks or on some, you know, random pond or whatever it is, walking through some arboretum. Like the fact that they could have very easily just come all the way from South America, or like, especially like, I love the map on the Merlin app that shows like their winter and their like year round ranges and stuff like that. And I remember talking with Thomas Mills now, like any habitat that's good for birds is really good for whitetail as well. And turkeys and like just about everything else. Like we can get, I don't know. I love the movement that we're seeing with prairie as well. And kind of this oak savanna push and everything. Cause like if we can get more people on board with that, like even if it's just a backyard prairie or, you know, batch of pollinators, whatever it's going to be, like if we can get more people introduced to it through that, I think we're in really good shape, because whether folks realize it or not, like that's the kind of stuff that benefits everything down the road. It's, and
exactly
lead us to a really good spot, I think.
But, yeah. And all these animals, like the habitat is so relational, and like these relationships between all these animals, it just all like, yeah, it opens your eyes to like, oh geez, this habitat improvement like increased the number of rabbits that are over here, and then songbirds. And like, it's just, yeah, it opens your eyes to like so much more than just whitetail deer, you know. Like whitetails are a very hard species to hunt. They're difficult to see, right? You can't just go out in the woods and see deer all the time. They run off. Like, you know, there's just so many things about them that's like pretty seclusive. And then like, you know, turkeys, you know, not as like secluded, and songbirds, geez, you can go out in the woods and like enjoy a day doing that. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, like it's not all about white-tailed deer. It's kind of like what I'm getting at a little bit. And it's just fun to like open your eyes to other species of, you know, animals that are super critically important to habitats and ecosystems.
Definitely. Is there a species? So like I've been nerding out on owls a lot for like the last year. Is there a species that's like a non-game species that just intrigues the heck out of you?
Oh man, I'd have to think about that. I mean, well, like they're a game species, but like bobcats.
Totally. Like
not, and it's not a bird. We've been talking about birds, but like bobcats, I'd say are like really intriguing to me. Like like their population rise in Southwest Wisconsin, just because that's what I'm familiar with, has been like huge. Feels like they're, I mean, I get them on camera all the time. Just like learning more about, I need to like spend more time learning about their behavior and like the habitats they thrive off of and all that. Like I'm super intrigued by bobcats.
Same.
Yeah. So that's like, I need to like dive into that more. They're absolutely just, they're cool. They're really cool.
They got that mystique to them.
They do. Yeah. They're super, they're reclusive animals that like, you don't really, I've never seen one in the wild yet, which is crazy. I spend a lot of time in a tree stand and I've still never seen one, but I've seen, I have buddies that have seen little kits and, you know, adults walking around. So that's cool. So they kind of intrigue me.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get one of the state fur bearer specialists on, and I haven't been able to get through. So anybody listening, if you know somebody who knows the heck out of bobcats and coyotes and fur bearers and just how they relate to everything else in an ecosystem, shoot me a message, because that needs to be an episode hopefully this year.
But sounds like a fun episode. I'll have to look into my Gmail and see if I have the contact info for one of the big like predator specialists, because we had a mountain lion on camera four years ago, and they came out, they drove out to the property and did measurements next to the trees and looked for footprints and stuff. So I'll dig around and see if I'll see if I still have his email original.
Dude, heck yeah, that'd be awesome. Well dude, we've been going at it for over an hour here. I know I'm in the middle of your work day here, and I appreciate you taking time out of the day. give us a quick update before we wrap up here. What do you got coming up with Yellowstone AI? What can folks expect to see out of your guys' office here?
Yeah, so a lot of big things. We got new data plans dropping within 1 to 2 weeks. Today's June 3rd, so hopefully within 2 weeks we got new data plans out there. A little bit lower, more competitive, got some cool add-on features that I can't quite spill the beans on yet. But so we got data plans coming, working on a new website that's going to look really sharp. I got some great content coming down the pipeline. So just a lot of cool things kind of coming together for us. We're working with some people to help get the word out and get some content going. Working to get our dealer network built up. So yeah, it's going to be a really good summer. Still a ton of people who haven't heard about us. We're still small up in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, but if people are up in Door County, swing on by. We're down on North 3rd Street, just across the main bridge there. So stop by in the office. We'll chat hunting and talk trail cams, but yeah, some awesome stuff going. We got some really good momentum headed our way throughout summer. So it's exciting stuff. Yeah, I'm pumped.
That's awesome. Heck yeah. Where can folks go if they want to learn more about Yellowstone AI, check out some of your guys' cameras?
Yeah. Check out our social media pages, just yellowstone.ai, and then yellowstone.ai is the website, not .com, just yellowstone.ai. And you'll see all of our products there. Y2 camera is kind of the flagship one, headed into summer and fall 2026, and then working on some stuff beyond that. But yeah, check out the website. Got all sorts of cool resources there, questions. And the best thing about our product is like it's super simple to use, lifetime warranty. So I think like it's just a different way to like do sell cameras. Like there's good warranties out there. There's good cameras. No question about it. But yeah, we got a lifetime warranty. And people who know me know that I'm like super particular about my cameras. So starting a new role at this company has been just like super exciting to, number one, see that the product is really, really good. And then like the people behind it also like are just even better. So yeah, we're a small team, but we got some awesome products. And I'm super excited about where things are headed.
Heck yeah. That's awesome, dude. Last but not least, if folks want to follow along with you and your summer and your deer season and everything, check out some of your excellent writing. Where can you direct them?
Yeah. So my Instagram is kind of where I'm like most active. It goes in spurts of being active, but depending on what I got going on in my personal life right now, I'm not very active because I all sorts of kid stuff, but Paulineer_hunt is my Instagram. And then, I got a lot of articles there in my link tree in the bio on my page, but do a lot of writing for Mossy Oak, some for deer and deer hunting, Drury Outdoors. So still kind of staying active in a number of different places, but hard to find the time during this time of year to crank out a lot of content. But yep, those are some of the main players where I'm doing a lot of my writing. So always appreciate people checking out my work. And send me a direct message if people have questions about stuff that, you know, or just want to chat deer hunting. Like I love that. So yeah,
heck yeah,
it's fun stuff.
Absolutely, dude, love it. Well, man, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to come on the show and talk deer and turkey and all the different things we covered today, man. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. Hopefully I'm in the works of planning a little trip up to your neck of the woods, maybe to Little Sturgeon Bay, with a buddy, do a little bit of fishing this year. Ooh, but if we make it up there, we'll definitely have to shoot up to the big Sturgeon Bay and drop by the office or something. So I'll be in touch about that. But dude, seriously, appreciate your time and look forward to the next time we chat, man. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Pierce.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Lone Wolf Custom Gear, Onyx Hunt, Huntworth Gear, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other awesome outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.